Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo, the Royal Historical Society, and host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Master Historian Professor Sir Lawrence Freedman. Sir Lawrence is a professor emeritus of war studies at King's College London. He is, without a doubt, one of the leading academic specialists on the topic of war and military conflict in the Anglophone world today. And indeed, today we're discussing his newest book, Modern Warfare, Lessons from Ukraine, published by Lowry Institute. Sir Lawrence, what can you tell us about the origins of the Second Russo-Ukrainian War?
I mean, I think you can tell this story over a very long period, as Putin often does. You can tell it over quite a short period in terms of the pressures building up and the way that Putin was viewing it in 2022. But I think the best place to start is probably a few years into Putin's first presidency in the Russian Federation, when it was clear he was becoming quite fixated on Ukraine. And then you have the Orange Revolution in 2004-05, in which he saw the pro-Western side was pushing very hard against the more Russophile, as he saw it, elements within Ukraine. And I think this had quite a profound effect on his thinking, that he saw the dangers, sort of a liberal contagion coming in from the West via Ukraine, possibly via Georgia, you can Armenia as well. I think you then fast forward to 2013, when Putin had the most Russophile president he was ever likely to get in Ukraine, Yanukovych, who he then undermined by pressing him not to sign an association agreement with the EU, which was a bit more than symbolic, but wouldn't be that impactful. But Putin feared it would be and wanted Ukraine to sign up to his own project, the Eurasian Union. So he managed to effectively bring Yanukovych down by forcing him into abandoning the EU, bringing people out onto the streets. And when people were out on the streets, then eventually Yanukovych ran away. That led to the first round of his fighting the annexation of Crimea, this sponsorship of groups actually Russian-led in the Donbass and elsewhere, and created a very uneasy situation, which Putin concluded was not tenable. And so in the middle of 2021, he started this campaign, which culminated in the actual invasion of 24th of February 2022. And I think it's a sense that Ukraine would drift away from Russia, that the only secure situation for Russia was to have a subordinate supine government in Kyiv, and a sort of arrogance that he could pull this off, using the FSB and as well as the military, he could so undermine and subvert Ukraine that it could be occupied and subjugated in a matter of days.
So, Lawrence, why do you characterize the Ukrainian approach to war as, quote, classical, and the Russian as, quote, total?
Yeah, I mean, I think basically, Ukraine is fighting on its own territory. I think since I first made the distinction Ukraine has been taking on more of more targets in Russian territory. But the distinction, I think, still applies. So a classical approach is basically that you're trying to win by affecting the military capability of the opponent by maybe in the end winning in battle, whereas a total approach is that you're affecting the will of the whole country, the society at large, to continue by making life miserable for the population, threatening the population. And Russia does that because it's fighting on somebody else's territory. It's occupying that territory as well. So it's a total approach against the whole society rather than just the armed forces of Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't have the same set of objectives vis-a-vis Russia. So while it does attack targets in the Russian Federation, these are claim at least to be military related, attacks on oil refineries, supply lines, railways, etc. Although obviously they have wider social and economic effects.
I'm sorry. What do you mean exactly when you say, quote, a strategic asymmetry has been most marked, unquote?
Well, you know, Russia is much larger than Ukraine. Has a much larger supply of manpower, and an economy which can keep going on the basis of energy exports. It has defense industries well in place. Ukraine is much more dependent upon support from the West and others. It has manpower shortages, so it's not quite a David and Goliath battle, but Ukraine is clearly on the face of it weaker, and its strengths derive to some extent from the quality of the weaponry it can get from the West, which by and large is superior to that that the Russians are producing. And in the end, it goes down to its sort of tactical and strategic agility and being able to make the most of what it has. But there are two, and because of the point made earlier about the sort of targeting, Ukraine can't target in the same way with the same effect the sort of civilian targets that Russia can target. The problem with the classical way of war is that you really need a battlefield victory, and that's very hard to obtain. We've seen in this war that defence tends to be stronger than the offence. It's quite hard to achieve military breakthroughs, and even if you do, they can only take you so far. These are both very large countries. I mean, Ukraine, there's a lot of territory being covered, so it's quite hard to make the sort of breakthroughs that real within the numbers that both sides have that can give you a clear military victory. So I think Ukraine's difficulty is that it's dependent upon affecting the will of the Russian leadership to continue the war by demonstrating that the war is futile, that the Russia can't actually achieve its objectives. The other problem with the classical approach is the distinction between combatants and non-combatants can be quite hard to sustain. Obviously, Ukraine has got every incentive, because it's fighting on its own territory, amongst its own people, to sustain that. But elsewhere, we know that we can see it at another conflict in the world at the moment, collateral damage. It's likely to be painful and unavoidable in some cases. And Ukraine has attacked targets in occupied territory that presumably have these consequences as well. And as mentioned, the attacks on oil refineries and so on, while have a military purpose and the gear to put in keeping the pressure up on the leadership in Moscow, obviously are going to be judged by their civilian social and economic effects as much as by their purely military effects.
What do you mean when you state that, quote, a problem with total war was a lack of strategic validation, unquote?
The problem with total war is total. I mean, you've got to have restraints at some point, otherwise you're not actually the point of the whole war goes, especially in the case of Russia. If it's trying to take over Ukraine, what in fact it's doing at the moment is every bit of extra bit of Ukraine it takes, it's battering to pieces, and there's nothing left of it. So strategically, I mean, total war is inherently very destructive, and it doesn't give you a way of gaining support amongst those who you're trying to occupy. It's not exactly a hearts and minds approach. So it's coercive. It's brutal. You can't say it can't work, because at some point the force may be irresistible. But it creates problems for the future as well, because if you succeed and gain victory in the war, that which you occupy is not going to be particularly well disposed towards you.
How exactly is modern warfare, quote, layered, unquote?
I think by this I mean that there's a tendency in war, in anticipation of war, to assume that the latest technologies push aside everything which has gone before. Wars are going to be fought afresh and anew with completely new technologies and methods. Whereas in practice, what you have is that warfare is layered, in the sense that previous forms of warfare that haven't become totally obsolete. So you may not have so much by way of cavalry charges or bayonet charges anymore, but you're still having trenches and artillery fire and armored vehicles moving forward, because you need some sort of protection while you move forward. So there's great continuities, even while you have some important new elements being introduced, whether cyber and AI or drones or whatever. So lots of the scenes from Ukraine are very reminiscent of scenes from past wars, even the First World War. And the methods being used to fight are often very similar, except that you bring in these new elements like expendable drones that can give units some sense of what's around them and where the enemy might be. So it's one thing on top of the other, rather than one thing supplanting another.
One in retrospect, explains the overestimation of the capacity of Russian forces prior to February 2022?
Well, they should have won. I mean, if you just looked at them, they were superior to Ukraine in every department. They didn't quite have the advantage of surprise, because people could see what they were up to. But there's still a degree of surprise, because it seems such a terrible and absurd thing to be doing in this day and age. So they should have done a lot better. I think it wasn't unreasonable to expect Russia to perform more effectively than they did. But they made some basic errors in the operational concept, and they were very dependent on assumptions that they had effectively subverted key sources of power within Ukraine, so that there wouldn't be much of a fight. And it was part and parcel of a wider hubristic view of Ukraine as an illegitimate country with an illegitimate government, not lacking in authenticity, run by neo-Nazis or whatever, led them to underestimate what was going to happen. So a different Russian leadership with the same project might have done a lot better. I mean, there were elements of them on the Russian side that we did underestimate in terms of the command capacity and so on. But, you know, looking at it again, you would still say the Russians should have won the conventional side of this war pretty quickly. The Ukrainians outfought.
Why do the Russians fail to take Kiev in the opening stages of the war?
This is quite a complex story. We're finding out more about it as we go along. I think first of all, the factors I've just mentioned, the hubris, that they have this sort of bold push to fly into the Hostomel airport, take it, and then use that to bring in lots of other troops on transport aircraft. And if they succeeded in that move, Ukraine would have been in some difficulty. But they, Ukrainian defenders, managed to hold it off for long enough and make it impossible for the airport to be used for that purpose. So that was important. They made travel towards Ukraine, towards Kyiv, difficult by flooding areas and so on. Russian tactics, Russian armour convoys were forced onto roads where they were vulnerable to being picked off because they were sort of almost in single file. Once you knocked out forward units, then those behind tended to pile up on each other. So there were big military operations. If everything goes to plan, it's fine. But as soon as two or three elements in the plan go wrong and you're forced into improvisation, then as likely as not, you're going to see delay and confusion. And that's what we saw. And by the time the Russians were starting to get themselves organised, they'd lost a lot of troops. Their morale was poor. Their logistical systems and command systems were stretched. And the Ukrainians were mobilised and fighting effectively.
Why do you state that during the evolution of the war, that the Russian army became more akin to a 20th century army, while the Ukrainians became more akin to a 21st century army?
I think that was true in the summer of 2022, because the Russians lost a lot of their kit and were forced to go back, and still forced to go back to using stuff coming out of storage, some pretty basic forms of equipment. While the Ukrainians were getting more advanced weaponry from the West. It's possibly less true now than it was when I wrote it, because the Russians are also, like the Ukrainians, using drones effectively. The Russians have stepped up their electronic warfare capabilities and so on. So there are elements of the Russian performance that are certainly more 21st century now. But even so, I think there's something very basic and harsh about the tactics that Russia uses and the equipment that it uses. They reflect a sort of a lack of sophistication in some of their capabilities. By and large, Ukraine, because of where they come from, Ukrainian air defense capabilities, artillery capabilities, are superior to those of Russia, except in quantity. I mean, the Russians still outgun Ukraine. So Russia has to make use of its quantitative advantages to make breakthroughs, which it has done recently, because Ukraine's quantitative advantage, Ukraine's manpower and artillery position has been pretty down.
Why was the man referred to as General Armageddon, General Surovikin, replaced back in January 2023?
So Surovikin was brought in because he was the favoured candidate of this sort of hardline nationalist wing. He was a very capable, effective general. And he brought some sort of order and direction to Russian strategy. Most importantly, in the long run, he built fortifications, which caused Ukraine serious difficulties when they tried their offensives in the summer of 2023. And he also initiated the attacks on Ukrainian critical infrastructure. But I think Putin saw him as being too defensive. He wanted to evacuate Kherson City and concentrate on getting good defensive lines while relying much more on the coercive aspects of the drone and missile strikes against Ukrainian cities. I think Putin found him too defensive, minded him want to defensives, even though the offensives he got, really all through 2023, were pretty useless when he had just used up lots and lots of people, achieved very small amounts of ruined territory. And then, of course, Sorovikin was close to Prigozhin, the head of Wagner. So when we have this curious, very brief Prigozhin mutiny, Sorovikin was implicated in that. So he was still playing quite a significant role in the Russian military effort, but was essentially relieved of all his duties after being too associated with Prigozhin.
In retrospect, was not the attempt by Ukraine to retain Bakhmut a mistaken one?
This is a big debate. You can certainly make the argument, and it's probably true, that Ukraine allowed its forces to be too stretched. A lot of good people were lost, a lot of ammunition was used up, and sometimes maybe it's best just to abandon positions and move to more secure defensive lines and then concentrate with a stronger punch, which is what was argued was lacking in southern Ukraine, to move the Russians in the 2023 offensive. And I think that's a very powerful argument against it. It's clearly the government of Ukraine finds it very difficult to hand over any more territory to Russia, because that just means more territory that's eventually got to be taken back. And they believe the attritional opportunities that the Russian forces left themselves open to the loss of thousands of their soldiers, either killed or wounded, meant that it was sort of worthwhile. The difficulty is with that argument is the Ukrainian losses at one point were getting pretty attritional too, and manpower as yet hasn't been the same sort of constraint on Russia. So then again, Bakhmut of course fell. So there's a strong argument that it would have been wiser to have much more defensive positions in Luhansk and Donetsk while concentrating the offensive capacity on the south. On the other hand, the difficulties that were faced in the offensive would still probably have been there, because of the mines, the minefields, and well-developed fortifications, and the Ukrainians didn't make an awful lot of progress. They could well have made more of them. Then, maybe we'd be telling a different story now. But these are very difficult choices. I think in retrospect, probably would have left Bakhmut to the Russians, but I think these are very hard decisions for a government to make, to sort of knowingly abandon an important place to Russian occupation.
In retrospect, would you say that the Ukrainian offensive of 2023 was either a mistake or at the very best premature?
I just think it was very difficult, and I think the difficulties to a degree were underestimated. And I think that's, you know, the proper responsibility of Ukraine's Western supporters as well as the Ukrainians. And that, you know, comes back to this central point that it's very difficult to penetrate well-defended positions. The Russians have found it difficult in the opposite direction. And it's difficult also to say to the Ukrainians, you know, to be patient and wait, because it's their territory that's under occupation, and life's pretty grim for those in the, who are being occupied. So I think the Ukrainians had to do something, and this will be debated. I mean, what it relates back to the Bakhmut debate. I mean, the one, if you look at the only or the most successful Ukrainian offensive in Kharkiv, it wasn't particularly in a vital strategic direction. They were able to take an opportunity of Russian forces had been thinned out and were not of the best. And they saw an opportunity and took it very effectively. And the difficulty with the 2023 offensive was everybody knew exactly what they were trying to do, where they were trying to go, and the Russians prepared themselves. So I think the challenge for the future, because undoubtedly the Ukrainians will want defensives in the future as well, is to find lines of attack that aren't so obvious and have an element of surprise to them. That's not going to be easy. But, you know, and it may just have to be, they end up being opportunistic. So I think it's a statement of the problems that Ukraine has in any offense. To say it was mistaken, again, it didn't work out as they wanted, so it would be better to conserve resources in retrospect. But very hard for the Ukrainian government just to sort of passively accept the Russian occupation of their territory without trying to do something about it.
Would you say that the employment of drone or drone-related technology a major change in the nature of warfare?
It's not a major change, but it's pretty important. And I think what's interesting is it's not just sort of drone technology. It's expendable drones that have made the real difference. I mean, we all expected drones to be important, but pretty capable, smart drones carrying their own, you know, missiles and so on, and so that the Americans have been using. And then there would be the kamikaze drones that would just be flown directly into targets. But the importance of customized or altered, pretty cheap, commercially available drones. But that was really quite significant. Thousands and thousands of these have been used. And it's hard to imagine future wars, well, this won't be the case. So I think that has turned out to be a pretty important development. You know, it produces a very transparent battlefield and vulnerability to anybody who's out in the open. So I think this is definitely something that will be studied from this war as an important factor for all for future wars.
Why did peace negotiations discussed in the early stages of the war not advance significantly, if at all?
I mean, it's very difficult to make a peace when somebody's invading your country and trying to occupy it. There's quite a lot now that's been written on the negotiations that did take place from February to April 2022. There are a number of issues. They did seem to make some progress on the neutrality issue, except Ukraine needed some security guarantees if it was going to accept neutrality, and that was, they never really got those. The negotiations haven't begun to address issues of territory, so Russia had yet to agree to withdraw its forces. And then when the revelations came out about what had happened to Bucha and Russian atrocities against Ukrainian civilians, I think the mood shifted within Ukraine to not only can you not trust these people to stick to agreements, but given the way that they behaved, they need to be prosecuted, they need reparations. I think the whole thing has got a lot more complicated. And I think it's a fair point that it may be unwise to try to end a war with a complex peace agreement. Wars tend to end, in the first instance, with a ceasefire, and then you can address the difficult issues afterwards. If you're having these complicated conversations while the war is going on, then something happens in the war which undermines their credibility. So, and I think that's... time I was pretty sceptical of them. I don't think anything we've learned about them suggests that they were as close as sometimes the Russians like that, since the Russians now to secure.
Given that this book was written in the summer of 2023, would you still argue that, quote, not a single element in Putin's strategy has worked, unquote?
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable how little he's achieved after 2 years. I mean, he's the stronger side. He's the one, this is the one that's supposed to win. Clearly, at the moment, because I couldn't, and I didn't anticipate, which was that Congress would sit on its hands for 6 months. Unfortunately, that has now changed. At the moment, Russia's making some progress, but it's still going to be pretty limited. And now the Ukrainians have had a morale boost after what could still be a difficult couple of months. They hopefully will be able to sort the situation. Now, if you look at what Putin wanted, he wanted territory, certainly. He hasn't got all the territory of all the four provinces he now lays claim to. And to stabilize the situation, he needs a supine government in Kiev, and he certainly hasn't got that. He's caused a lot of pain in Ukraine. He's caused a lot of death and destruction, but he hasn't actually defeated Ukraine. So, yeah, I'd stick by that.
In the book, you make reference to, quote, 8 points of military power, unquote.
Oh, the bit at the end of the book. Yeah, I think the problem with military power, and it seems a very decisive way of getting, imposing your will, but it's full of pitfalls and difficulties. And unfortunately, governments keep on forgetting about these pitfalls and difficulties, so embarking on adventures which don't help them achieve what they want, but that still impose tremendous costs on their victims. And, I think one hopes that the lesson of this war is it's very hard to make aggression pay. And we can't say aggression doesn't pay at the moment because the war's not over. It's all got some way to go. But for the moment, the Russians have got very little at an enormous cost. I mean, I think it would be very hard to anybody to say that if Putin had known exactly where he'd be 2 and a bit years later, he would have embarked with such confidence on this aggression. The other point they're making about military power are, the difficulty of occupying places where you're not welcome. Also the difficulty of anticipating an opponent when they're about to do something stupid. So it would be nice to think that the logic of this, or the lesson that is drawn from this, is best to be much more restrained when contemplating big military operations. And the West has got its lessons from the past that it could draw too, and one hopes that China might draw a similar lesson in the future as well. Hard to be optimistic, but that's the point.
In this weekend's Financial Times, you had a piece in which you state, quote, "Now we return to this prospect for a never-ending war," unquote. Why so?
Yeah. Because there isn't an obvious way of bringing it to a conclusion. It's not a prediction that it will never end. It's an observation of the no obvious way of bringing it to a conclusion at the moment. And I think that's where we are. Russia, I think, put a lot of effort into winning the war earlier this year. While it had a lot of advantages in manpower difficulties with the Ukrainians, the air defences, ammunition, artillery shells, all of these things favoured the Russians. And it's only just now starting to get some advantage from that, and it may not last. So, yeah, I think the Russians may have missed an opportunity to make major breakthroughs. The Ukrainians have got a long way to go before they can push the Russians out. So what you're relying on is a change of view. I would say it has to come in Moscow, but this is just not a war that's worth fighting anymore.
So, Lawrence, if you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
It's just very difficult to get wars right. You may think you understand how they're going to develop, but it's actually an unfold, especially when you start them. But stuff always happens. They tend to go wrong. And this is true for people. It's true once they're underway with people you would like to do well, as well as people you want to do badly. It's very difficult. And the more people keep that in mind, the fewer wars we may have.
On that observation, which I would like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Sir Lawrence, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Coutillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of New Books Network. Thank you, Sir Lawrence Breedon, very much.
Good to talk to you. Bye.